I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to the Wild Tales podcast. I'm Jason Fox, and this series is all about adventure, resilience, and inspirational humans. The podcast is presented by The Book of Man and in partnership with Talisker, the single malt whiskey made by the sea. My guest today is Tobias Gutteridge, Tobes to his mates. He's an ex-Special Forces operator and Royal Marine Commando who was shot while on tour in Afghanistan and paralysed from the neck down. He is the founder of Bravery, an extreme sports brand that supports charities for underprivileged children and discharged members of the armed forces. And he's basically a man who dedicates his life to empowering people to overcome the adversities they face in life. In this episode, we answer some questions that you've asked me on Instagram. I'm going to be sending a Talisker sea salted caramel gift to the top question. In addition, malts.com are offering a 10% off promo code Talisker15DE, all uppercase, redeemable at checkout on www.malts.com until the end of December 2020. Discounts may only be used once for individual Talisker Distillers Edition products for sale at £100 or less. No minimum spend, but a delivery charge may apply. Not to be used in conjunction with any other offer, and gift card purchases are excluded. 18 plus and subject to malts.com terms of sale. Anyway, here we go, and I hope you enjoy this episode. Okay, everyone. Hello. I'd like to introduce, as I already have done, but I'll do it now formally, that Toby's here. Toby Gutteridge, he's a guy that I served with quite a long time. We served together a while ago, and he's got an amazing story to tell. So without any further ado, Toby, mate, it's been a while since we've seen each other, to be fair. We don't catch up enough, and that's all my fault, not yours, obviously.
No, don't be silly.
We need to, we're going to go right back to the beginning. Your life as a young lad growing up in South Africa, what was it like, mate?
Yeah, well, South Africa, geez. I was born in 1985. And back then, South Africa was a different country. You know, it was still under the apartheid regime. So, you know, people weren't allowed to socialize together and, you know, things like that. So it was a different country and it was very strict and very rigid, I would say, growing up. I was born in Johannesburg, and it was just a different world. South Africa, it's a fantastic, beautiful country. It's got all the scenery, you've got all that stuff on your doorstep, but at the same time, you got all the crime and the complications. It was an interesting childhood, to say the least. Put it that way.
Do you reckon were you exposed to the sort of crime and the violence as a kid growing up, or not really? Did your parents sort of protect you?
No, absolutely. You can't avoid it, Foxy. It's everywhere. You know, every night you're locking up your doors like you live in a fort, you know, and it's tough. You always know someone who's been affected by it in some serious way, whether that's a hijacking or a family member who's been murdered or theft or a break-in. You know, it's just part and parcel. And the thing is, you just numb yourself to it. So you just get used to it. You think it's normal, to be honest. my childhood, I mean, I didn't have a very good family life. My dad left when I was very, very young. He, you know, the usual sob story when, you know, dad, you know, left, and mom was left to grow, bring up four children by herself. And yeah, she struggled. And so it's kind of left to my own demise. And that just meant, you know, it's kind of fending for yourself, to be honest.
Were you the oldest out of the four of you?
No, mate. So I had an older brother, which was a godsend. And then I had two younger sisters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How much younger than you were they?
I've got one who's 2 years, 2 years younger than me. And then I got a very young one who's 10 years younger than I am. So she's the little baby of the family. Bless her.
So, mate, did your older brother have any influence on you? Because what I'm getting to is, you know, you're big into extreme sports. When did that start for you, like the extreme sports side of things, motocross and that?
Well, you know, my brother wasn't anything like me. My older brother's nothing like me at all. He's a proper SWAT, as we'd say in the military. You know what I mean? He went off to, you know, university and made a life for himself, and totally different to the road I was going down. And the road I was going down, which was, let's say, not a very good one. I was out causing trouble. I had no real boundaries, so I was causing a lot of trouble, getting in trouble with the police, and I was using extreme sports as just a way to express myself. So that's how I got into it. And I wasn't big into the conventional sports, so I wasn't big into rugby or, you know, cricket or swimming, athletics, things like that, which in South Africa are huge. You know, that's like everyone does it. Everyone is into those things. But I wasn't going down that path. Maybe I was, you know, rebelling and all that. But anyway, I ended up, you know, getting into the dirt bikes and, you know, skateboarding and surfing and things like that. And I was using that as a way of expressing myself. I really enjoyed it. It turns out I was actually pretty decent. I just sort of picked it up and just rolled with it. And I really loved it. It's kind of how I went.
Which one was the one that you preferred out of all of those sort of like disciplines?
Oh, mate, what a question. It's going to have to be dirt bikes, you know. The dirt bikes for me, enduro riding, you know, out there on the bikes was just awesome, man. I loved going down to the coast and, you know, getting in the water, which was, you know, mega.
Yeah, decent. There's decent land around there. I have been to Johannesburg, actually. In fact, I went there not that long, 3 years ago, and, like, I can't imagine what it was like when you were growing up there, because even then I still noticed that there was a mega edge to the place. Do you know what I mean? And so I liked it. I really liked Joburg, but you could definitely tell you had to be careful with what you're doing. So God knows what it was like back in the 90s. You know what I mean?
It's Johannesburg is one of those, you know, I love it. I always will. But, it is what it is, you know.
Mate, that sort of, you're into the extreme sports, you're growing up, you sort of, I suppose extreme sports, would you say extreme sports was what's keeping you on the straight and narrow a little bit, as opposed to going too far. Too far, getting into trouble and all that sort of stuff?
Yeah, I'd definitely say that. Because, I mean, it was something that you wanted to do and you enjoyed doing. Whereas if I didn't have it, I'd probably be out causing more trouble than I was in the first place. And that was, you know, quite a lot of trouble. you know, so I would definitely say that it was something to do other than, yeah, cause trouble or, yeah, just make a nuisance of yourself. And again, it's a cool way of, like, expressing your character, you know. Like I said, I wasn't that, like, you know, typical South African, you know, oh, you know, got to play rugby, smash it all, you know. I wasn't into that kind of thing, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
It wasn't really my style.
When did you decide to come over to the UK? Was it the military that sort of, like, was that your big sort of, like, pull to the UK to join the British military?
Yeah, it's an interesting one, actually, because, you know, I'd seen the Marines before, the Royal Marine Commandos in South Africa before, and there were rumours of them going around, you know, how proper badass they were and, you know, the stuff they got up to, you know, and it was, so that was already, like, you know, always in the back of my mind going, you know, what's this all about? Kind of thing. And then as I started getting a bit older, started getting to about 18, and I thought, shucks, what am I gonna do with my life, you know? And I wanted a challenge. I wanted to do something different. I wanted to travel, and also my dad, well, my sort of stepdad, or my mom's partner, I don't know, partner, sort of, he was in the South African military. So that had probably had quite an influence on me from a very young age.
Yeah.
But obviously I wasn't going to join the South African military, because by the time I was old enough, 18, I mean, that was just you can imagine how bad it was. That was never really an option. I thought, you know what, I'm actually going to do it. I don't know where it came from. I just woke up one morning, it was completely random, and I was like, you know what, I'm just going to go for it. I had no idea what I was doing. I just packed a day sack, and I was like, I bought a flight. I was working in some bar. I just saved up enough cash, got a flight, and came over to the UK. And I didn't even know where I was staying. I mean, I landed at Heathrow and I was like, okay, now what? You know, cool, right, let's do this. You know, okay, where's the nearest, sign up office or something? I had no idea what I was doing.
You haven't even spoken to anyone in the careers sort of side of things in the Marines over there. You just sort of, like, did it just blagged it.
Just blagged it, mate, completely blagged it. I was like, yeah, okay. I mean, I'd heard a few things, and I'd probably Googled a few things and that, but there wasn't much you could find on it. But from what I'd heard, you know, Royal Marine Commandos, you know, British Royal Marine Commandos, toughest of the tough, you know. And I think at that time they were using the slogan, 99% need not apply, or something like that, something chat.
But basically, just going back to that recruitment advert that they created, which was that 99.9% need not apply, it was apparently the worst one, because apparently most people looked at it and were like, well, I better not apply then, because I'm probably in that 99.9%. Apart from you, obviously, but...
Yeah, exactly. I must have been that 1% that it did actually apply to, you know. But that's what I was looking for at that time in my life. You know, at that time in my life, I was really looking for something different, something to really prove to myself that I was more than just the average Joe, you know, going through life, something like that, you know.
Well, which careers office did you go to sign up? Like, because you went in blind, really. You landed in Heathrow and were like...
Yeah, I went from Heathrow and London was just too hectic, because I was trying to find a job. So I was on all these career advertising places. Anyway, I eventually ended up somehow in Bristol. Don't ask me how, but I ended up in Bristol. And I was renting this room, one room, and I was stacking shelves in Tesco's in Bristol at night. I was stacking shelves at Tesco's so I could afford a gym contract to try and get fit enough. And that was it. That's all I was doing, training and packing shelves at Tesco's. And then, yeah, I went into the Bristol recruitment office down in there, the main center, town center. Yeah. And first I just went in and was like, yeah, I want to join the Royal Marines. And this guy just looked at me and he was like, okay, cool. Fair enough. And that was really, yeah, where it started, to be honest.
What, how long did it take before you were actually in Royal Marines training from that? You know, when you went into that office?
I reckon it was about 6 months, maybe 6 months. Yeah. Shit, maybe so a bit less, maybe 5 months.
Yeah, but you were still cutting around having to like stack shelves and renting rooms and stuff like that.
That's it, yeah, and trying to afford a gym contract so I could, you know, get in there and try and get a bit fit. But yeah, that's really what I was doing, and just training, you know, running. I'd pack a day sack and just do, you know, running into town, running back from work. That was about it, to be fair. Wasn't really focused on anything else.
How did you, when you turned up to Limpsden, which is obviously Commando Training Centre, that's where all the Marines go to get trained for all the recruits.
Yeah.
How did you find it?
Are you talking about for that PRMC, you know, that pre-training, that little 3-day
or
proper first day?
All
one.
Of it.
Yeah. I mean, okay, first of all, well, I mean, let's just jump into day one. When you turn up for training, you know, and you all, as you're going to Limpsden on the train, you know, you can see the lads that are jumping on that are also, you know, got their bag on their back, whatever, a carry-all, and they're in a little suit, and they got this sheepish look on their face, you know, like a deer in the headlights kind of thing. And no one wants to say anything, but we all know we're going to the same place. And then you get off on the train at the little stop outside Limpsden, and your DL comes down, and from then it's just like, I mean, you just go with it, don't you? I mean, I just went with it. I didn't have a clue what I was going to do, but it was daunting, man. It was really daunting. It was pretty daunting.
It was honking. I remember mine, like a DL for anyone is a drill leader. He's basically the guy that looks after you for the first few weeks, tells you how to wash yourself and clean your kit. But I remember that first few weeks, you know, maybe all of it for me, but it would just seem like a blur.
It's a complete blur, especially those first probably 6 weeks, 8 weeks, until you start to find your feet a little bit and you start to know who's who and
who's actually going to pass. I didn't find my feet until week 28, I reckon.
week 32.
How old were you when you joined up?
Yeah, I was about 19.
And then, so obviously, I mean, we could talk about Royal Marines training forever.
But yeah, of course we could, you know.
It's like it is, it's just a slog, isn't it? And you obviously got through that, finished. I mean, how did it feel to actually finish and know you had somewhere proper to live?
Mate, I remember passing out of training. It's probably one of the best days of my life, I'll be honest. Yeah, it was the biggest accomplishments I'd achieved. I was buzzing, mate. I was, you know, cloud nine, and just knowing what I had achieved and coming through it was just, it filled me with this massive sense of new confidence, you know.
Did any family come over for that day? Because it's, I mean, it's a long way to come, but I was just wondering whether anyone came over.
No, mate. Typical standard my family. I remember phoning my mother and saying, you know, oh, this is my pass out date. I'm actually going to pass out, you know, as in get, I was going to say get badged there for a second, but no, you know, you get my green light. Yeah. And man, she wasn't even interested, I'll be honest. She just, she didn't give a toss. So on, you know, on your pass out day and all the families are there, I was a proper camp orphan, mate. Jack Jones, you know. But I had a very good friend in training, a very good friend, and his family just took me under their wing. And, you know, so yeah, but, you know, I wasn't bothered. I was proud of myself. You know, I was super proud of myself.
Yeah. That's a good thing about the Marines, isn't it? You know, even if you haven't got a family or, you know, you're a long way from them, there's always someone there where you can go back to. There's always a place you can go back to with mates and stuff like that, even if you are a camp orphan.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what happened. You know, the lads just got around me. And I mean, it was what I was looking for, you know, I guess. Because, yeah, some holidays, whenever it was holidays, they'd just be like, mate, come back to mine. You know, come back to my family, you know, get together or Christmas. Have Christmas with us, and I spent Christmas with lads in training, you know. That was just my experience of the Marines and the camaraderie was these guys that hardly knew me were like, yeah, just come back and spend Christmas with us.
Yeah, it is awesome. It is an amazing group. Yeah. What, mate, after training, which unit did you go to? Which commando unit?
So after training, I went straight to 40 Commando because I was dead keen. I was dead keen to get out on ops. And they were like, yeah, 40 Commandos, the next one. And at this time, Afghan was kicking off pretty bad. Yeah. And 40 Commando was the next one's going out. So I was like, cool. Yeah. And because not sounding like blowing my own trumpet here, but being passing out as a original, they were like, okay, you get, you know, the pick of whatever unit you want to go to. So I was like, sweet. 40 commandos straight out on ops, they're going out, I'll go there. So yeah, I went straight to 40 commando.
And did you go straight out on a tour?
Yeah, I was there for about I can't remember now, but it was probably 6 months or something, because we had to do PDT, pre-deployment training and all that, and get all your gear and, you know, all these other little bits. So it's probably about 6 to 8 months, and then yeah, straight out on my first tour of Afghan.
How was it?
Again, it was just that, like, it's just a blur, you know. It was hectic, you know. We land in Bastion, and then from there it's just you're bombarded by all these senses, and you know, it's just crazy. And then before I knew it, yeah, we were off to a FOB out, you know, up at Northern. So we were up at the 40 Commando was, you know, sanging up to Kajaki all the FOBs from there. I think Bravo was at sanging, Alpha Company was at FOB Inkerman, and then I can't remember where Charlie was. Charlie was at Kajaki, I think. I don't know where Delta was. I can't remember exactly. But yeah, I was Alpha. So we went straight up to FOB Inkerman, and we took over from, it was an army regiment, and they were just getting hammered, mate. Hammered, absolutely hammered. When we got there, there was nothing, literally nothing. Just four compound walls and a couple of blokes living in squalor. Just squalor, mate. That's the only way I can describe it. There were no, yeah, I mean, they were, you know, going to the toilet, just burying it in sand, you know, and we're on, if they got a, you know, resupply every few months, they were lucky, you know. It was rough. It was rough. And we took over from them, and they were just like, just good luck, good luck. That's all they said, really, to be honest. And it was intense. Around that period as well, it was hectic.
So was there a lot of, how long did you spend at that FOB?
I'd say 6 to 8 months straight.
Yeah.
And we were supposed to obviously have a handover after 6 months and come out, because it's only 6 month tours. But because there were just so many delays, it was probably, we ended up only coming out about probably 7 or 8 months later. And that was just living there with nothing. The best we got was 10 man rations, which, you know, Foxy, mate, it's not good.
Mate, it does your guts no good, not for 8 months on that shit.
No, mate. And it was a really hard tour. I know Mark Ormrod's come on your podcast. It was the same tour he got injured. There was that tour when he was injured. My corporal was killed on that tour. That wasn't very nice. It was tough. It was hard. And it was a massive eye opener, I'm not gonna lie, as to, geez, I'm now in it, you know.
Yeah, as in like how serious it is.
Yeah, and it hits you straight away. It's not, now all of a sudden this isn't Lymston and running around Woodbury Common, you know. People are actually shooting at you, and you know, anything can happen at any time on these patrols you're going out, you know. It's not fun and games. It becomes very serious very quickly.
It's quite a horrible feeling, isn't it? Can you describe that feeling about just before going on patrol, walking out the gates of Bob Inkerman?
And I'll never forget it. I'll never forget that. We're all down at the gates at Bob Inkerman, ready to cross over, you know, into the green belt. And you're just thinking, you know, every time, a good chance we're going to come under contact here, or something's going to happen and someone's going to get hurt. You have this gut-wrenching feeling. But at the same time, you know, you're also filled with, this is what I signed up to do, and I'm gonna do it, come hell or high water, you know.
Yeah.
It's a very scary feeling. It's a very scary feeling.
So when did you first decide that you were going to go for the special forces?
Yeah. So when I was on this tour, actually, a couple of the SB lads came up to the FOB, and they were doing some sneaky beaky stuff from there, going out and doing some stuff in the middle of the night. And when everyone asked, who are these guys? Everyone was like, oh no, you know, you can't talk to them. Don't, you know, can't ask questions. It's all, you know, this, that. And that just intrigued me. And then eventually I think I spoke to my sergeant major, and he gave me the same answer, you know. He was like, oh, don't worry about it, you know, just, yeah, forget about it. But I knew something was up here, so I just went and spoke to him. And that was the first time I'd even heard of the SBS, or the Special Boat Service. You know, I thought the Royal Marines was, you know, top dogs, yeah, you know. I started speaking to them, talking about them, and I just got chatting with them about what they do. And after that, that's really just so, where the seed was planted. And that's when I thought, you know what? I got back from Afghan. did a few more, just a few more years in the Marines. And then I applied for it. So I thought, because from then I thought, yeah, this is the road I really want to go down to. I looked into it a bit more, obviously, and got a bit more information about it. So then I decided, yeah, this is really, I think this is what I want to do. And I must have put in for it, fairly recent after that.
And then you found yourself on selection.
Selection. There we go.
Colin, let's talk to you about your experience on selection, because we've all got it. Whenever I look back on it, I'm like, it's awesome, but it was dark.
That's exactly what I was going to say, because I was going to say, well, when people ask me, what was selection like, special force selection? The first thing I want to say is it was awesome. I loved it. Absolutely loved it. And I was like, yeah, this is why I joined up,
Yeah.
But yeah, I loved it. But there were some dark, dark times.
Yeah, it's hard work, isn't it? It's fucking hard.
Yeah, it's a slog. It is a slog. And that's a slog from day one, The hills, they're not easy. But you can kind of prepare for the hills, I suppose.
Yeah.
If you do practice your map reading and you know the area and everything, you can get, you're fit enough, you can get through it.
Mm.
But after that, mate, it's just, the jungle. What can I say about the jungle? That'll test any soldier, That's really where you find out what you're made of,
It's on the course for a reason, isn't it?
Yeah, 100%. If you're disciplined and you're self-disciplined and that comes down to your hygiene, everything. If you're not on it, the jungle will eat you alive, man. It'll just eat you alive.
Yeah, it does.
You can see it.
So you pass selection. That is an amazing feeling, isn't it?
Yeah.
And then you join the special boat service, and you came into our squadron.
That's right. Yeah, yeah.
So, mate, you joined our squadron. I think it's safe to. Well, I'm going to be biased now, but I think we had a good squadron. It was a good bunch of us. What was it like? What was it like coming in? I've got my own experiences of when I was new and joined, but how did you find it coming into to the squadron, mate?
When I joined the squadron, I thought I was going to be slammed with a lot of SPROG routine, and I thought I was going to be absolutely having to work my way up the kind of the pecking order and all that, which I was totally ready for. But
yeah,
what I wasn't prepared for was how opening the lads were, how accommodating and how warming the lads were towards us, and to me especially, because I was so young in respect to my military career. I hadn't done that long.
Mate, were you 20, if I remember rightly, were you 25?
No, mate, I just turned 24.
Oh, right, okay, yeah.
Just, yeah, 23,
24. Right, I remember it was, you were, age-wise, you were young, weren't you? Yeah, I remember.
Yeah, I was young and pretty naive, and I was blown away by everyone getting around me and, because it's all new kits and new, just everything's new. So it was just great to see so many guys coming around and getting around me and showing me how to,
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Do things that are easier and you know what I mean, like getting a cage sorted out and everything. It was fantastic.
You do get thrown so much kit that you've never used before.
Yeah, that was it. So much kit that you've never seen before because you just don't see it in the Marines. So it's all new, even all the weapons, you know, everything. Yeah, sure, okay, you use the weapons on selection, but it's very basic, you know. Like, you don't get all the, you know, the extra bits, the add-ons and all that. You don't get, and all the, you know, cry gear and, you know, helmets and all that. You don't get any of that. So, and you've never seen it before.
You've got to get your head around all the tech kit as well, haven't you?
Like, yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah.
Like, just so much stuff.
And but, new radios, that was pretty intense. And just different SOPs, completely different SOPs. It is a bit of the learning curve is so steep, but the lads are just, they'll just get you through it. You know, now you're in. So it's pretty cool. It's pretty awesome.
Toby, you joined the squadron, and I mean, I'm recalling this as I remember it, so I might be slightly off a little bit, but if I remember rightly, we pretty much went into pre-deployment training to go out on our own tour then.
That's right, yeah.
And we flew out, it was 2009.
Yeah, that's right.
It was just at the end of August. I think we set off at the end of August. And we flew in and we took over from an outgoing squadron, and we basically went in to, I would suggest it was the most hectic tour I'd been a part of. So your baptism of fire with the special boat service was pretty full on. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would. I'm not taking away from any of the other tours before that, because I know it was all pretty hectic.
Yeah.
But I remember we took over from M Squadron, and it was pretty hectic. I remember they had just suffered mass casualties, and
they were ready.
Remember
that? They were ready to go home when we got out there, and
yeah, you remember that?
Yeah, I remember it really well. And there's a friend of mine, you know, died in that, and then obviously we. We went in, I remember our first proper job was, I mean, we're not going to talk about it, obviously, but...
No, we can't.
And you know what it was, which one I'm on about, but it was, you know, it was full on. Someone died, I think, did you think I'd died? There was a lack of communication on the ground, wasn't there? It was mental.
Yeah, and I don't even know if, because there were two things. So I can't say too much, but honestly, I was certain it was you. From what I could see there, I was certain. I mean, it was pitch black, but from what I could see, I was like, yeah. And then it came over the radio, and I was like, what? But it didn't quite add up according to, you know, who was where and things like that. But it was only... I don't remember, but it was only probably when we got back.
I'm glad you were wrong anyway.
It was one of those.
I mean, that was us hitting the ground running on that tour.
Yeah.
It kicked up, and we're getting to a point in this tour that obviously we're going to talk about, but I mean, your experience on that trip out there. I mean, even before the main incident, you were involved in some gnarly stuff. You know, you picked up a wound early on, didn't you, on a job?
Yeah. That was another crazy one. Off the cuff one. Again, I don't know how much I can say, yeah, but you probably remembered as well, Fox. I think you might have been in the opposite.
I think we went, it was during, you know, every now and again we do stuff in the daylight, and it was a bit of a firefight. And I think, you got shot in the arm, didn't you?
Yeah, that's right. It turned into one of those where it was one of those unpredictable ones. But anyway, yeah, we ended up hitting the ground running, and I think we were caught with our pants down a little bit. And the helos bugged out, so we didn't have much of a choice but to, you know, just move forward. But it's what we train for and it's what we do. But it was complete. I got shot in the shoulder, or in the upper arm.
Upper arm, yeah.
Yeah, and the most from it.
Go on.
Is getting back and just getting absolutely ripped. The lads just proper ripping me to pieces. Like, there was no mercy, no mercy, no sympathy, no quarters.
I got to say the banter that we had out there was so, it was great.
Oh, well,
it was so ruthless. So, I mean, I'm going to explain this to the listeners. So Toby got shot in the upper arm. It was a flesh wound, fortunately. It wasn't like mega serious.
No, straight through, in and out.
And the lads just absolutely rinsed him.
Yeah.
Not in a bad way, just in, you know, it's just that way of getting through that sort of...
It is.
Those situations. But, mate, you got over that. You didn't even go home, which is testament. You know, that option would have probably been there, but you decided to stay out, just sort of look after the wound, make sure it got better, and then you went back at it. And
I
can remember you being quite frustrated in that period where you were just letting it, you know, you were having to rest up a little bit, and you were like getting all narky.
Yeah. I remember that. Because the lads are going out, and someone's got to take your place. Someone's going to take your place, and you're just feeling, getting all this pimped up frustration, and all you want to do is, help and be part of it. You know, this again, it's that camaraderie. You know, I really didn't want to let the squadron down, especially because I was one of the new lads.
But you didn't, mate.
No, mate, but I do. I feel like there'll always be a part of me, Foxy, that'll always feel that. But it's, you know, these are things that I had to deal with. And these are things that I had to cope with throughout my journey.
I know. But just like, from whatever it's worth, my point of view is you put a shift in long before you needed to anyway. But, mate, let's get to the night in question, or the one that we're all going to get to. It was an operation that we went on. It was a long way away from where we lived. There was a long flight in.
I'll
just hand over to you.
You know what, I can't actually remember that much, if I'm honest. I remember us prepping, heading down to the pan, getting on the helos, and that's where it really becomes very hazy. I know it was a massive long walk in, and I can't remember much more than that, to be honest.
I'll try and put some meat on the bones, but I think it was that far away we had to refuel on route.
That's right,
I think there was an issue with the helicopters where we had to wait for a bit longer. They're all standard. And then we ended up going in. Like you said, we got dropped off a way out, long walk in. Then we just came up against the compound, and it was it went noisy quite quickly, if I remember rightly.
Yeah. And that was in the first compound. And then a few insurgents bugged out and then moved up. And there was a separate compound. And as we got up to that one, the door was locked. But it was bolted and closed with, I think it was a chain or something. And we wanted to blow in, but the powers that be said no. And in which case, we, kicked the door down, all that. But I think that gave them plenty of time to set up shop, if you get what I mean. And just as we came through, it was just walking into a wall of bullets, really.
So basically, so for everyone listening, it's quite, it was a hectic night.
But, it was, yeah.
Toby got shot, and you went down. There was a lot of commotion that went along with that, because obviously there's a gunfight going on. You've got a casualty, and there was, I think, two guys worked on you, didn't they?
Yeah, that's right.
Two guys were working, two lads that we know really well, they were working on Toby. Everything else was going on, and there was a lot of confusion as to what had happened to you. I'm just filling in a few blanks here, mate, if that's all right.
Yeah.
And obviously, because of the severity of your injury, which no one really knew how it was going to play out, and if I'm honest, a lot of people thought the worst, they called in the helicopter, the casualty evacuation helicopter, one of ours, came in, and you got taken away with, I think the two guys working on you went away as well. So there was three guys gone off away, and no one really knew what was going on. And we didn't know what was going on for a long time, if I'm honest. It was quite, we had to get on with that night, and we ended up getting away from there. It was a long, drawn out evening. And then we came back, and I'm just filling this in so you can then get on with the real, like, your side of it. But
yeah, sure.
It was the following day that we'd found out about the injury. As far as I remember, it was it C2?
Yeah, C2, spinal cord had been damaged.
So Toby had been shot through the neck. And it basically shattered C2, which is quite high up on the backbone, isn't it, on the neck?
And
we didn't really know what was going on, but there was a lot of work going on to try and do as much as they possibly could, and that was all we found out.
Yeah, I mean, that's all you probably would have found out at that point. It was only when I got back to probably the UK, they're feeling the more light was sort of shone on how severe the injury was and what the implications of that injury were. I bet it must have come as quite a massive blow to the lads.
It was a blow, but more importantly, what about, your journey? I mean, when did you start to, when can you start remembering after that? Because ultimately, all you can really remember is the long helicopter flight, maybe a long walk in, and then it's hazy. When did it start to become clear again? Because obviously you must have been on a hell of a lot of drugs. You were in a coma, no doubt, for a long period of time.
I was, I can't remember how long, but I was in a coma for a long time, and I woke up. You don't know. I don't know. There's not much. You wake up and you just don't believe it. To be honest, you don't even believe it yourself. You just don't believe it yourself, and you just go through it, and you let time do its thing. You go, you try and tell yourself, I mean, you're hanging on to any any bit of hope there is, I'll be honest, you're hanging on to anything, you know. You've been told the worst possible case scenario, and you're just thinking to yourself, oh, well, maybe like something will happen, you know, like some new technology or some new medical science or something. You're just hanging on to anything. You just need time to go through the grieving process, which, you know all about. It's the same as the loss cycle, that grieving cycle of going from acceptance to anger to frustration, and you're bouncing all over the place. But yeah, you just need time.
Just for the benefit of people listening, what were you actually told when you were fully compassed and you were ready to, you know, start rehab, I suppose, if whatever that looked like? What was it that you were told by the professionals?
The professionals were straight off. They were like, you're never gonna, at this point, I was in really bad shape. And they were like, look, you're not gonna talk again. You're not gonna eat or drink. You know, you're gonna be fed through a, you know, tube into your stomach. And obviously you'll never move from the neck down. If anything, you're gonna have slight head movement, and that's about it. You're gonna struggle to concentrate, you're gonna struggle to bright lights, all these things, you know. All the worst case possible case scenario. And that just what can you say to that? What do you say to that? You just, like I said, you're just clinging to any hope at this point.
How did you get yourself through those periods? I mean, to be told that is, I mean, it's hard work, you know, you're going from where you'd come from to that.
I guess you just try and, you know, you just try and stay positive as much as you can. You know, you resort back to your training and your confidence, and you try and boost yourself up. And the only thing you can do is just try and let time be the healer. Time be the healer, because your emotions are all over the place. They really are. And you can't make heads or tails of it. And, you know, you're just praying that you're going to come through it at some stage. At some stage, things are going to get better. And I guess you just keep telling yourself that. Yeah, those are the initial thoughts when you're going through it. But also, actually, there is this feeling of, well, at least I'm alive, you know. Yeah. if that's anything, and I was like, you know, I'm still here, I've still got some form of, you know, sort of some sort of fighting chance.
You still got something to give, but I mean, exactly. you come on to what you can, what you give, which is how long were you in hospital for? Because I remember myself and one other lad, we came to see you in, can't remember the name of the place, it's near Salisbury, so we came there. But you were sort of, how long were you in for? Because it was a long stretch, wasn't it?
It was a long stretch, mate. So I was transported to Salisbury spinal unit after I'd sort of initially stabilized from, you know, the initial shock of the injury and everything, all the yeah, once they stabilized me to a point where I could move to maybe a spinal unit, which was based in Salisbury. And from there, I spent 12 months, 12 months on my back, staring at the roof, just trying to get healthy enough to maybe then see what the future looked like. But it was 12 months of just staying in bed, trying to get strong again, you know. That was hard in itself. I mean, I'd say that was one of the toughest times.
See, that was a long time, and then it obviously everything's been a long time, hasn't it? So everything's been a slog, like housing, getting yourself into a position where you've got the right people around you, and that obviously it's been a long, long journey up to that point, or up to this point. But when did bravery become sort of like an idea bubbling away?
So this is really important, really. So when I had finally gotten out of hospital and I'd gotten back, I'd come back to camp, and I was staying on the marriage quarters, and I was finding it extremely difficult to cope with my injury. I was finding it difficult to try and get back into society. I didn't want to see the lads for obvious reasons. I felt alone. I felt, I was in a really, really bad place. I was in a really bad place. And eventually it got to the point, and I'm not afraid to say this anymore. And I'm quite proud of it to say this. I had a complete mental breakdown.
Yeah.
To the point where I'd had enough, and I had to be shipped off to a hospital based in Southampton, which is, people go for severe psychiatric problems and things like that. I was at my wit's end. I'd had enough. I thought this is the lowest I'd ever felt. I didn't want to go on. That was it. And it was from there I started, I met a guy, a psychologist, who's now a very good friend of mine. And he started working with me on a one-to-one basis. And the first thing he said to me was, "Tobes, I want you to just think of three things that identify your character, you know, in a positive way. Three things that make you you." And that was hard, but I did. I looked at it, and I went away, and the three things I came up with were that I was passionate, I was determined. And I was, I'd like to think of myself as quite an honorable person. And I just kept, and he kept reiterating these three things that I should keep remembering, and then think of examples in my past and throughout my life so far that have exemplified these characteristics or traits within myself. And slowly I started building myself back up, slowly. I got to a point where I was strong enough to think, okay, what do I want to do with the rest of my life? And that's when bravery hit me. And I was like, I want to do something that's going to be a force for good. And how can I do that? So I wanted to start a company that was called Bravery. And that's really where it started and where it comes from.
What does it say? For people that don't know, what is bravery?
So what is bravery? I mean, bravery is it's an extreme sports brand that's inspired by surfing, motocross, and that. But ultimately, it's inspired by the message of the word, which is getting people to believe in themselves again and being brave in life and getting through whatever life throws at you, never giving up. And that's what it's about, really. It's a lifestyle brand, you know.
And ultimately, it's delivered by the one person that's shown the most amount of bravery out of anyone I know, to be honest. It's, you know, you are the bravest person I know. You've been through, you've been on a journey that's it's unbelievable. I mean, you know, I've seen you every now and again, the sidelines, not enough, I know. But if anyone's going to talk about bravery, you are the first.
You know, you're a celebrity now. You know what I mean?
Whatever.
Come on.
But ultimately, bravery is, it's, you know, it you represent it and it represents you, and it's awesome, and people need to, you know, people need to go and have a look at it, because it means a hell of a lot more than what Toby's just said there. It means a hell of a lot more, and it's inspired by a young man's journey from the bottom of something, and he's still got the passion and drive to keep going on. Mate, yeah. It's awesome. But what do you find fulfilling about it now?
You know, fulfilling, it gives me purpose. It gives me purpose because, you know, bravery, the brand, is ultimately, it's about helping others. Yeah, sure, it's a company and it's, you know, extreme sports clothing and gear and things like that. But ultimately, it's about helping other people overcome their own challenges in life. Now, that no matter what that is, and we all know that everyone's struggles in life, it's all relative to them. You know, my struggles are different to someone else's struggles. So yeah, and that's what I find the most fulfilling, is helping others, I think, and also staying in touch with the things I'm passionate about. So the extreme sports world, the motocross, the dirt bikes, the surfing, and all that. So I enjoy those because I get out, I get to go to events and things like that. So I really find that pretty cool. When I get to hear someone's story of how bravery, the brand, has inspired them, and how it's helped them, I just feel like, yeah, you know, my job is done, and I'm still doing what I was ultimately trying to do when I was in the military, which is help. You know, I'm still doing that, just on another platform. That's really cool. So that's really fulfilling, you know. I love it.
Awesome. Right, before we move on to a reader's question, because I'm aware of the time.
That's cool, yeah.
What if there's anyone out there listening who's in a dark place, who's in what we'd call rock bottom, what advice would you give them?
Don't dwell and stew on how bad it is. You know, you've got to remember who you are and how and what you've come through so far. Think of the things that identify you as a person, and you know, think of one good thing about yourself. And just stick with that and build on that. You know, it's hard. You know, it is hard. So you just gotta, you know, dig deep, believe in yourself, keep moving forward, keep putting one foot in front of the other. You know, and things will get better. They will. It's just, you know, don't keep in those bad places. And the other thing I would say is seek help, really. It's not a weakness or don't be ashamed to seek help. I had to seek help. I had to. And it took me so much courage to seek help because, yeah, I didn't think I needed it, and I didn't think that it made me maybe less of a man. But it was the best thing I did, was to seek help, and that's where, I learned all these things that helped me get through it.
Yeah, you're not alone. That's one of the main things I'd say. Right, mate, let's move on to, I'm going to flick through these questions and try and pick one that's worthy of, basically, okay, this is all right, this is good, right? Congratulations on your first class honours degree in business studies.
Yeah, I mean, what can I say?
What made you decide to study for a degree, and is it a bit part of a bigger picture, bigger plan? That's from someone on Instagram called Josie JLEJ. So if well done, Josie JLEJ. Here's Toby with the answer.
Yeah. What made me want to study a degree? So obviously being paralyzed, I knew that, you know, I'd have to rethink what I'm going to do with my life. And I figured it's going to have to be on some form of educational path. So I just started back at the beginning and started my educational career again and built it up slowly. And also by this point, I knew I wanted to start a business, and I knew to do that probably needed some sort of knowledge in business. So I was like, yeah, sweet. Okay, cool. Let's try and study some business. And yeah, really just followed on from that. But as far as a bigger plan, yeah, I was just trying to get some sort of platform or to be able to start a business.
And you're obviously, the bigger plan is obviously to grow Bravery, isn't it?
Exactly, yeah. The bigger plan would be to grow Bravery as a business. And to do that, what better place than to actually get an education in business? Yeah, so started at the ground level, ground roots. And now again, I had to go right back. So I had to redo my GCSEs because, you know, I'd been out of education for so long. Everything that I'd done, it was now, you know, useless. So I started back GCSEs, and then I went on to college. And then I decided to do a business degree and really get some strong foundations within business, instead of just trying to blag it, which is what we do in the military all the time.
We've done it my whole life.
Yeah, I have.
Mate, it's been awesome, but Bravery is yours. It is an amazing business. It's an amazing message. I mean, I've got some of your kit. I love it. Where can people find out more about Bravery?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a fantastic, awesome brand. So if you want to find out more, and by all means, please do follow us on Facebook. We've got a Bravery Facebook page, and that's at bravery.org.uk. That's the username. On Instagram, we're at bravery_UK. And yeah, the website where you can pick up some of our stuff or our gear. And we got some awesome stuff coming up next year. You know, some serious high-tech quality products. So yeah, and that's www.bravery.org.uk. Check us out.
So yeah, everyone check out Bravery. I mean, mate, Tobes, you are an absolute inspiration. You are a legend. Yeah, I really appreciate it. You coming on. And
thanks, mate.
Please, everyone listening, go and take a look at Bravery, because it is born from an inspiring individual. You are, mate, you're a legend. And I remember what you were like in the squadron. You were a fucking tough bloke. So thanks very much for coming on, mate, and sharing your story.
Yeah, no. Thanks so much for having me, Foxy, and it's been a real pleasure.
Thanks very much to Toby. I hope you enjoyed it. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast if you don't already, and follow me and the Book of Man for the latest news. Thanks again to Talisker for supporting this podcast, and thanks for listening. I'll see you again soon.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.